Good morning. Ready for day four? So today is where we're going to continue our journey looking at defending control systems from a network and communication perspective. If you just remember the way this course is laid out, we started off on day one where we laid the foundation to understand what we're talking about with control systems, the different types of control systems, the communication gear, the protocols, a lot of the terminology, the general layout, structure, and approach we're taking to security. Then once we understood the foundation, in order to be good at the defense, you have to understand the offense. One of the phrases I like using is if the offense knows more than the defense, you're going to lose. You're going to lose every day, every week, every month, because if they know more than you do, you're not going to be able to be successful. So in order to win at security, you have to think and act and get in the mind of the adversary to understand how they operate and function. And one of the things I always tell my students, if you want to know whether you've made it to be a security professional, you've become a security professional when all of your friends, relatives, and neighbors call you a paranoid freak. So when everyone starts saying, you're so paranoid about what the adversary is going to do, you're always thinking like the adversary, that's at the right spot. That's where you want to be. And that's what day two is all about. Getting inside the mind of that adversary, understanding how the offense works. Then once we understood how the offense works, we can then use that to build a defensive model to protect and secure our systems. Day three was about securing and protecting the systems themselves, the operating systems, the locking down, the protecting, and the securing. Today, we're going to talk about securing and protecting at a network level and controlling and managing the flow of information. While yesterday is absolutely important, securing and locking down services, as we've covered in most cases, that's something where you're going to have to do it pre-deployment. Before you do the final acceptance testing and deploy into production is literally when you're going to go in and lock down those systems. Once it's in production, you're not going to be able to do a lot of changes, alterations, or modifications. So a lot of what yesterday was monitoring and looking for changes in the host. Well, monitoring and looking for changes in the host is great, but it's not scalable. If you have 5 or 10 or 12,000 devices on your network, trying to go in and look at each one doesn't really scale. So one of the things we pushed hard yesterday is one of my favorite tools for protecting and securing in control system environments is correlation devices. We spent some time talking about the logging, the correlation, the analysis piece. A SIM is one of the best components for being able to correlate the data from those hosts. The next important thing is to monitor and track and watch the network traffic. Looking at traffic flows, looking for anomalies, unusual activity, because in a lot of cases, that's going to be the delivery mechanism for these attacks. They're going to go over your networks, your WAN connections, break into remote field devices and use that as a way to get in. So in a lot of cases, being able to monitor, watch, and look at the network traffic is going to be a key method of success. One of the other things I mentioned a little bit yesterday, but I want to reemphasize, when I teach 401, which is pure play security for traditional IT environments, one of the mottos that I use is prevention is ideal, but detection is a must. And we emphasize that you want to try to prevent as many attacks as possible. What's the problem, though, with prevention? The problem with prevention is you can only prevent things that are 100% bad. Preventive devices must have a zero false positive. If I have a zero false positive, what naturally happens? You have a very high false negative, which means naturally, based on how preventive measures work, you will miss a lot of attacks. If you have traffic that 80% of the time is bad, 80% of the time it's indicative of an adversary, can you block it? Absolutely not. Why? 80% bad is 20% good. So if you're going in and you're preventing traffic or activity that 80% of the time is bad, you are blocking 20% of your legitimate customers. You are blocking 20% of the legitimate traffic going across that network, which means as adversaries get more stealthy and sneak through your network, preventive devices are going to be less and less effective, and you're going to focus more energy on the detection piece. Second is, in this day and age, you have to accept the fact that no matter what you do, no matter what you put in place, you are going to get targeted, you are going to get attacked, and you are going to get broken into. That's just the reality. You can spend all the money you want on security. You can hire all the best people in the world. But no matter what you do, you will get targeted, attacked, and broken into. Now, I know when I first say that, especially on a Saturday morning, many of you are thinking, wow, Eric, you missed your calling in life. You should have been a motivational speaker. Because what a way to motivate people on the weekend, but say, no matter what you do, you're going to get owned. However, it really shouldn't depress you at all, because that's exactly how you approach life. There is no one in this room that says they will never get sick. There is no one sitting here today that is saying, I am the perfect specimen of a human and I will never, ever get sick for the rest of my life. None of you would ever say that, because you know saying you will never get sick is naive. Every one of you sitting in this room has accepted the fact that you will get sick, and your approach to life is minimizing the frequency and minimizing the impact it has when you get sick. So if any of us start feeling under the weather, we are going to immediately address it, take vitamins, go to the doctor, and try to minimize or reduce that impact that it's going to have. But we all accept and realize that sickness, unfortunately, is a reality, and we deal with minimizing likelihood and impact. That's the same approach you need to take to security. Your organization needs to recognize that they will get broken into. Saying that your organization will never get broken into is as naive as saying you will never get sick. It's going to happen, which means in a lot of cases, especially when we're talking very high worth targets like critical infrastructure, if you have a very advanced adversary, a foreign government, a military, a well-organized criminal element, and they're targeting you, in some cases, preventive measures are postponing the inevitable, because they're going to keep going. It might take them 1, 2, or 3 years, but they're going to get in. And if you read the news, unfortunately, you have seen some very large organizations that focus in on critical infrastructure have unfortunately been targeted and broken into, and it will continue. So therefore, we have to recognize that if that's a reality, we do put some energy in preventive. We try to go in and at least prevent things, but in control systems, most of our energy is on the detection. Recognizing a advanced adversary will get in, and we focus a lot of energy on looking at network traffic and trying to detect and defend the enterprise. So that's going to be a lot of the themes today, is trying to go in and prevent what we can, but putting most of our energy and effort on the detection measures, really trying to detect and catch that adversary as quick as possible. And when we laid out yesterday, notice we try to prevent initially, but then it's detect, detect, detect is where you spend your energy. So this is setting up. All right, throwing markers this morning. So this is going to be your initial design of your system. And this is going to be your ongoing maintenance, where you spend most of your energy and effort. You will periodically retune preventive devices, but most of the time, once your preventive devices are up and running, they are what they are, and then you put a lot of the energy on the detection, the monitoring, the analysis of what's occurring and what's happening. Now, the first thing we need to cover before we get into today's material is you need to understand how good or how bad your organization's doing from a networking perspective to see where the gaps are. So one of the self-assessments that I would like you to do next week is take either a network diagram or a listing of all the security devices you've purchased over the last 5 years. So whichever's easier for you, either a spreadsheet of all the security devices you've purchased over the last 5 years or a network diagram showing all your network security devices. Either one works. Then grab a few colored pens, and I want you to go in and take one of the colored pens and all your security devices that are preventive, put a P, and all your security devices that are detective, put a D. If you're like most of our control system customers, when you add that up, 70% of your security is preventive and less than 30% is detective. Because detective requires more ongoing costs to maintain, organizations prefer on the preventive side of the house. So that's the problem there. If you're putting most of your energy on preventive measures and little on detective, that could explain why you're having a lot of challenges and issues, because those preventive measures will fail. Personally, I like to see it almost flipped in control systems. I would prefer to have about 25 to 30% on prevention and 70 to 75% on detection. That's really going to go in and give you that much better return value. So that's problem one. Problem two, if I want to effectively detect an adversary, what are the things that I'm going to try to detect? I'm going to try to detect command control channels. I'm going to try to detect beaconing. I'm going to try to detect lateral movement. I'm going to try to detect extraction or attacks against your data. Question. All of those things I just mentioned that we want to detect in a control system environment, do those occur on the inbound traffic or do those occur on the outbound traffic? They occur on the outbound traffic. The outbound is where all those visible signs occur. Therefore, if you want to be effective here, it's inbound prevention and outbound detection. It's the outbound traffic in which you're going to detect an adversary. The problem is most organizations are monitoring the inbound traffic looking for signs of attack. What's the problem with the inbound traffic? A, there's lots of it. B, it's very noisy. And C, it's very easy for an adversary to hide. If you have all the sensor data coming in from your field devices, and how easy is an attacker to blend in with that? But there's not as much going out, and therefore it's easy to catch. So it's the outbound analysis in which you win in this space. Now take that list of security devices or that network diagram and take a new colored pen. All your security that's focused on inbound analysis, put an I. All your security that's focused on outbound analysis, put an O. Add it up. If you're like most of our clients in this space, 90% of all your security is inbound and less than 10% is outbound focused. That's the second part of the problem. Organizations are focused all their energy on what's coming in and they're not looking at what's leaving. And that's where the damage occurs. And the really neat part about this is the outbound traffic in control systems is so much cleaner and easier to find the anomalies. The inbound stuff is so noisy, it's going to be really, really hard to find attacks. But it's the outbound that's a cleaner view of your environment. So if you want to understand where the biggest problems are today from network design and network security, the first problem is organizations are typically putting too much on prevention and not enough on detection. And the bigger issue is the detection they are doing is only on the inbound. They're not looking at anything leaving their environment. So if you want to start getting a handle on this, I suggest you start focusing a lot more on outbound detection. And really what it comes down to, just start building a profile of normal activity and then look for anything that deviates from it. I'll give you my three favorite. I can give you a ton of these and I will as we go through today, but I'll start you off with my three favorite because it's easy for me to say outbound detection, but if I'm not giving you concrete things to look at, then it's not going to be as effective. Here's my three favorite. Length of the connection, number of connections, and amount of data leaving your network. So ideally what you want to do is you want to go in and build a profile of what's the normal number of connections, length of connections, and amount of data leaving your system per IP address, and then anything that deviates by a value, 15-20%, you want to investigate and look at to see indications of compromise. I'll take it even further. I'll give you a test that so far I have 100% accuracy on. And I need your help. I need you to go back and do this test in your environment and tell me if I'm wrong. But so far, all of our clients and all of our students in this space, when they've done this test, always comes back with the same results. Here's the test. Go into your network and you can go in and look at the outbound net flow data. So you can go in and you can use a switch to do this. You can use a router to do this. You can use a firewall to do this. You can use a SIM tool to do this, whatever you want. I want you to create three lists. The first list is a top 20 list of the 20 IP addresses that are making the most connections out of your network. The top 20 IP addresses that have the highest frequency of outbound connections. That's list one. List two, create a top 20 list of the IP addresses that have the longest connections outside of your organization. Third list, top 20 of the systems that have the most data leaving your organization. Once you have those three top 20 lists, I want you to look at any IP addresses that are on all three lists. Any IP address that's on all three lists, investigate, and I will bet you it's a compromised system. I will bet you it's a compromised device. And please, if you do this, and you find an IP address on all three. Now, it's got to be all three because you can have systems that's on one of those that's normal activity. But if you have a system that's having the most connections, the longest connections, and the most data, it's the correlation that wins here. I have never seen a situation where those systems are not compromised. They're not broken into. And this test is great because when we go in, to a lot of our clients that deal with manage and control, control systems, often the executives are reluctant and skeptical. Oh, we don't really have a problem. We don't really have an issue. We don't really have a lot going on here. So literally we have to prove fairly quickly that they have a bigger problem than they realize. And literally within a week, we create those three lists. We find there's typically going to be 4 to 5 IP addresses on all three. We investigate and we go back to them and go, okay, we just found 5 systems. We spent less than a week, less than 40 hours, and we just found 5 systems that have been compromised for 7 months, 14 months, 18 months, and 22 months. Just wanted to let you know that. Have a nice day. And as we're walking out, they're like, whoa, whoa, come back now. Come talk to us. We got their attention. Notice, I'm not doing scare tactics. I'm not going in with a bunch of slides saying, things are bad. You're going to be attacked. It's the end of the world. Run. Save yourself. That stuff doesn't work real well. That's emotions, and that's not going to scale. I walk in with factual data. Listen, You might like me, you might not like me, but the data doesn't lie. You got to let data drive decisions in these spaces, not emotions. So if I walk in with the actual data and show them that we found compromised systems and here's how long they've been compromised for, you might not like it, but it's the actual fact and they can't argue with it. So if you can actually get and find that data, that's how you start winning within the space. And that's going to be the approach and strategy we're looking at today, is we're going to show you how to get all this designed and set up, but then we're also going to focus on the ongoing detection components that we just laid out for you. So we're going to go in and look at some network fundamentals. We're going to be geeking out a little bit on some protocols this morning, but don't worry, it's not too bad. We just need you to understand how computers communicate and operate. And the reason for that is simple. If I want to monitor your communication and detect you doing something harmful to my company, what is the fundamental requirement for it to work? I have to speak your language. I have to understand your language. If I'm monitoring all your email and I don't speak your language and I don't understand what you're saying, I have no clue of finding adverse behavior. I need to speak the same language you do to identify any unusual activity. Therefore, if we need to do what I just laid out and look for anomalies, we need to speak the language of computers. If we don't understand their language, you have no chance of being able to see, find, and catch that anomalous traffic. So that's why we're going to spend a little time going in and showing you how to analyze it. Now, the good news is, while you need to understand the fundamentals of it, we have translators for you. The best bet is if I want to monitor your traffic and I don't speak your language, yeah, I can spend 8 years becoming proficient in your language, but the better bet is understand the basics and then hire a translator to translate for me. That's what a tool called Wireshark is. A tool called Wireshark is a translator. It will be able to go in and take all that complex traffic and decode and analyze it for you on the fly to be able to see what's happening and what's occurring in your environment. So we're going to go in probably about midday, right around lunchtime, and we're going to go in and do a lab where we're going to run Wireshark, and it's going to go in and let you decode, and then it's analytical tools for you to be able to go through and better see what's happening. In essence, think of Wireshark as your translator. It's going to help translate and analyze the traffic for you. So as we go through these sections this morning, don't get overwhelmed if it's a lot of new concepts, because we'll give you tools for helping you be able to analyze that information quick and fast. Then once we understand all of that and we can start looking for and catching those anomalies, then we're going to go in and look at firewalls, look at one-way prevention, look at data diodes, and talk about all of these measures that we've laid out here on preventing and dealing with the attack vector. We're then going to revisit wireless security a little more, because more and more and more control systems are moving to wireless communication. And then we're going to finish up with a little bit of good old fashioned crypto. We were realizing that very often when we teach this class, that it would be on a Saturday. And we were realizing that while protocols and decoding and even wireless can be fun, we really, really, really wanted to give you something very cool and exciting and give you a real special treat. So when we all got together, we couldn't think of anything better than rewarding you at the end of the day with crypto. I mean, life doesn't get any better than this. So I tell you, if I could be anywhere doing anything in the world at 4:30 today on a Saturday in Singapore, I tell you, it's all about the crypto. So we're going to go in and talk about symmetric, asymmetric, and hashing, and how we utilize symmetric for confidentiality, asymmetric for authentication and the secure channel for the secret key, and hashing for integrity of the messages. And the funny thing is, I know you're all laughing when I say that, But my colleagues in the back aren't laughing because unfortunately it's true. I love this stuff, right? That's what my PhD was in, is in crypto. So yeah, we could go all day on this. The good news for you, and this can give you peace and hope as we go through today, is I don't know if you've noticed, but we've pulled out the good chairs for you. If you notice, we have our very specially designed chairs because there is a wedding in here tonight. And the deal with the hotel is that we have to be done by 5:30 on the dot today when the class is supposed to end. So the good news is that at 5:30, my friends in the back actually pull out tuxedos and they start going in. And if any of you have seen the movie Beauty and the Beast, be my guest, they're going to start running in with trays and start doing their dancing. So I have to be done right at 5:30 so they can put on that show for you there. So at least we'll make sure that we're done on time because of that. And those of you that want a little fun, hey, what's the other good movie out there? Wedding Crashers. So hey, you can stick around, right, and have a little fun tonight. So either way, we'll be in good shape there. So that's going to be the layout for day four and what we're going to be covering. Before we get into the details, the way that I like to start every morning is just checking in, making sure everyone's comfortable, seeing if any questions came up last night, see if there's any concerns, anything you'd like to go over before we embark on the journey of defending our networks from an ICS perspective. Any questions, comments, concerns? Excellent, excellent. As you know, I love questions during class. Keep them coming. We're having a lot of good interaction throughout the week, but I just always like to check in just to make sure we're all in really good shape and we're all happy. So with that, with big smiles on our face, let's jump into some of the network fundamentals, looking at some of the key principles of networking and control systems, understanding physical and logical topologies. The easiest way to think about them is the physical topology is how are you receiving the data, and the logical topology is what is the meaning of the data. So if we look at this classroom, the physical topology in this classroom is a wireless star topology. I am going in and directly sending each of the information to you a star, and I'm using wireless as the communication mechanism. So the way you're receiving the data is a wireless star. The logical topology is the English language. I am speaking English. Well, most of the time I speak English. When I talk for 4 to 5 days, I make up periodic terms. But most of what I'm saying is English. You speak English. So the English is the logical topology. That's the meaning of the information. So with computers, we need to do the same thing. How are your control systems and your HMIs receiving the data from the field equipment, from your RTUs? Then how are they applying the meaning to analyze, process, to be able to determine what's happening and what's occurring within that respective environment? Then we're going to look at some of the network devices, switches, routers, hubs, and bridges. And then we're going to go in and look at some of the ways we can configure our switches with VLANs, virtual local area networks, network access control, and 802.1x. So that's going to be our first module this morning. By nature of the definition of control systems, we have sensors typically in remote locations in which we need to receive information from, and we have devices that we need to communicate with, like pumps and valves and others, to control and manage how they operate and work. So if the whole idea of a control system is you're going to have sensors, you're going to have supervisory control that takes information from the sensors, performs logic and analysis on it, and then pushes commands and controls back to field devices, by nature of that setup, communication is a fundamental part of that. We have to be able to go in and communicate back and forth between those different devices. Even if we look at your hotel room and we look at the temperature control. Even in there, we have sensors in the room that need to communicate back on what the current temperature is. Then we have a thermostat that we set the temperature, and it needs to communicate. And then there's going to be logic that says, okay, what is the current temperature? What is the set temperature? What is the acceptable error? And then either turn on or off the cooling or heating to adjust the temperature appropriately. And if you notice, I used your hotel room as the example. I didn't use this classroom because clearly in this classroom, there is not communication between the sensors and the HVAC unit, because either it gets way too hot or way too cold in here. So clearly the communication is not working in here. So I didn't use our classroom as an example, but hopefully in your hotel room, you have a good, nice temperature. So just based on the problem that we're dealing with in control systems, communication from a networking perspective is critical. You're almost always going to have some form of wide area network communication, because you could have devices on oil rigs, remote locations, pipelines, nuclear reactors, sensors under the ocean. So therefore, it's natural that you're going to be able to have a lot of communication infrastructure to push and pull the respective data. When we look at some of the networking terms that we're going to run across, it's important we understand and differentiate between LANs and WANs and FANs and PANs, because each one indicates a different problem set and a different method of communication. The starting point for talking about types of networks is, of course, a LAN. A LAN is a local area network. The easiest way to describe a LAN is this is a communication structure in which your company owns, controls, and manages all the equipment that processes and flows over the data. So in a local area network, all of the routers, all of the switches, all of the cables, all of the communication media, your organization owns and controls. The nice thing about a LAN is because you own and control all the equipment, you can implement security at many different levels. You can implement security at the transmission level, at the switching level, at the routing level, at the application level, because you own and control all the equipment. However, what's the drawback? If you own and control all the equipment, you are limited to a geographic area, typically a building, a single site, or sometimes even a floor in a building. You're not going to be able to run your own cables across the country. You're not going to be able to run your own cables across the ocean. So with the LAN, it is restricted to a very limited geographic area. Where we're going to be running across LANs is in each of our different zones. So your business network is typically in the one site going to be a LAN. At the one processing site, your supervisory control network is going to be a local area network. On that one site, your DMZ is going to be a local area network. So it's in a limited geographic area, such as a building or a single site, in which you control and manage all the equipment. Now, LANs are great from a security perspective because you control and manage all the equipment. What's the problem? What if you have multiple processing facilities, one in Singapore, one in South Korea, and one in Australia? Those local area networks in each of those processing facilities need to communicate information back and forth. Well, you can't run your own cables across those countries and across the ocean, so you need to go in and get wide area network connections. This is where you go to a third party provider and either get dedicated lines or multi-protocol label switching or other forms of WAN communication to be able to allow you to be able to communicate large distances. Now, the benefit of a WAN is your data can now flow over somebody else's equipment so you can communicate in large dispersed areas. What's the drawback? Your data is flowing over somebody else's equipment. You don't own the equipment. You don't own the gear. And therefore, in wide area network connections, your primary method of security is encryption of the data. Now, this is where we have a little bit of a problem. Because in traditional areas, if you're doing very sensitive transmissions, then encryption of the data primary deals with confidentiality of your information. So if we're a pharmaceutical company and we're transmitting very, very critical research that could be worth billions of dollars, encrypting and protecting the confidentiality of the information is important. As we talked about in control systems, in some cases, the confidentiality isn't important. It's the availability and the integrity of that information. So therefore, a lot of your standard solutions of throwing VPN concentrators in front of the WAN connectors to encrypt the data might not necessarily provide the security and protection that we want. We might have to go in and utilize cryptographic hashing for the integrity, which is not always a common method in traditional IT arenas, but it is in ICS, and we might have to have multiple alternative WAN links. So if one of those goes down, we can preserve the availability of the system. So this is where we have some unique challenges within control system environments, as our WAN links need to be more focused on the availability and integrity and less focused on the confidentiality, which is often what most organizations are concerned with. So some of the typical services of auto encryption might not necessarily scale as well as we want in this specific space. Then, of course, we have the internet. We all know the internet is the worldwide super information highway. And because you can get internet connectivity almost anywhere, it provides a nice backbone for communication. However, what's the problem? The internet is totally unprotected, unsecure, and what's the big reason on why we don't typically like using the internet for direct communication? What is one of the criteria that we're dealing with in control systems? Availability. 3 to 5 second delays in communicating with devices can have detrimental outcome in some environments. If you have a device that's failing and it takes you 3 to 5 seconds to know that it failed and 3 to 5 seconds to provide alternative measures, that can have devastating outcome. What's the problem with the internet? Nobody can guarantee bandwidth across the internet. The internet is an unregulated network, which means over the internet, you can periodically have delays. You can periodically have routing issues. You can periodically have dropped packets. Now, many students will say, oh, come on, Eric. I use the internet all the time. We use it for business purposes. It's not that bad. It is that bad. Here's the problem. You're using protocols that are very fault tolerant. You're using protocols in which slight delays isn't going to be a problem or an issue. What are you doing on the internet? Email, web surfing, texting, posting, analyzing information. All of that is extremely fault tolerant. And if there are slight delays, it's going to have minimal to no impact on you. If you send an email and it takes 4 seconds to get there, you're not even going to know. You're not even going to realize it. And now think about it. When you surf the web, is there anyone in here who every single time they surf the web and you type in a domain name and hit enter, it always pops up instantly, 100% of the time? No, think about it. There's times where it takes a second or two. There's times where you have to hit reload. There's times where it might take a little longer. But that's all acceptable because even though the web, we want the results as quick as possible, it is a near real-time solution. It's not real-time. And therefore, slight delays are acceptable. However, when you're dealing with the communications and control systems, we need real-time. Near real-time, slight delays is not acceptable. So because of the unpredictable and unregulated nature of the internet, we tend to try to avoid it for our communications for all the reasons that I just laid out. The other big problem with the internet doesn't have any boundaries. The real world has boundaries. When I traveled to Singapore, I just didn't get off the airplane and wander around. I had to go through immigrations and customs. I'm formally registered as being in Singapore. When I wake up in the morning, after I become conscious and look at the South, if you ask me what country am I in, I could tell you. I know that I am currently in Singapore. When I go back on Monday, I can tell you exactly when I'm back in the United States. In the real world, there are physical boundaries, and you know what country you're in at any given time and the associated laws that are tied to it. The next time you surf the web, stop. What country are you in, and what countries are you going through to surf to that website? You don't know. If I'm in Singapore and I search to a website in Singapore, I go to a website in Australia, or I go to a website in the United States, I have no clue. It's completely transparent to me, which means we don't really know where our data is going and who could be intercepting it. So in some cases with critical infrastructure where confidentiality might not always be the top priority, we might not necessarily want foreign adversaries, foreign governments, or foreign entities to be able to see, monitor, or analyze what's going on. And in some countries, control system data is export restricted. You cannot export it out of a given country. Well, guess what? If you're export restricted, you better not use the internet because you don't know where you, oh no, Eric, I'm in Singapore and I'm connecting to our office that's only 10 kilometers away, also in Singapore. So I'm staying within Singapore. Probably not. On the internet, the shortest distance between two points is not a straight line. There's a very good chance that even if you're only physically 10 kilometers away, when you make that connection, it could go through South Korea. It could go through Australia. It could go through the United States. The way the core routers work are not based on shortest distance. It's based on routing algorithms that have many other parameters in place. So if you're dealing with export restricted data and you are using the internet, you could be getting yourself in a lot of trouble really quickly because you don't necessarily know where that information is. So that's why we have to be real careful on this thing called the internet. Then one of the newer terms that we start seeing out there is what we call a FAN or a NAN, a field area network or a network area network. This is where you're going in and you're in essence creating a mesh network where you have a lot of field devices that are all connected as relay points. One of the areas that we see a lot of these types of networks is with smart meters. With smart meters where you're now going in and having devices at everyone's house that can communicate back automatically via wireless, they're not running a direct connection for each user. In essence, each house communicates with the next house, communicates with the next house, and eventually gets close to a DMARC point that pulls in and analyzes that information. So if you have a lot of remote field devices that are separated by short distances and you want to get that information back to a location, instead of doing long haul links for each one, which is very expensive, we just have this device connect to that device, connect to that device. So if we just briefly look at this here, if we have Graham, who is our control center, and I'm a remote field device, and each one of you here is a remote field device, one thing we could do is each one of us could have a long haul back to Graham. We could go in and look at cellular, satellite, or wiring. The problem is that'd be very, very expensive, and that'd be a lot of communication. Instead, if this is geographically accurate, the better solution would be for me to communicate with this sensor, who communicates with this sensor, communicates with this sensor. Oh, okay. Yeah, we want to get done early today, so we're just flying through the material now. So I would go in and communicate with each sensor, and now the closest sensor to Graham would communicate with him, and he would relay all that corresponding information, and that would be a much more quicker, efficient method of being able to go in and perform that same communication with an easier, cheaper way of doing that. So that's where we go in and we see a lot of our neighborhood area networks popping up and using that communication mechanism. Then the other one we see are personal area networks. These are typically networks that are tied to an individual. So now you might have a field technician that actually has a Zigbee device that's connected to his ear, that has a communication device on their belt, that has a tablet in their hand, and all three of these can communicate together in order to be able to exchange, analyze, and perform information. So as we talked about yesterday, where we're using technology to more effectively go in and work with field technicians, that's an area where that works. We see PANs a lot when you're working in high-risk areas. If you're working in a nuclear utility, there could be areas that potentially have leakage that could be hazardous to humans. Now, normally, it's pretty well structured and isolated, but still, when you're walking around that facility, in some of the newer plants, you actually have a sensor or a watch band that's going to be communicating with an earpiece and even communicating with a GPS device. So if all of a sudden there is accidental leakage, you're going to get notification. A sensor GPS is going to get notification, and they're going to be able to go in, and either you get out of there or they could go in and send rescue personnel to be able to work on that respective individual. So we're starting to see that also for safety reasons, having these personal area networks in place. So in most facilities, you're going to see all of these different types of connections coming into play. Just to give an example of how this works and some of the communications, one of the protocols that's used out there is ICCP, the Inter-Control Center Communications Protocol. Essentially what this does is this allows a utility to be able to send information and details to another entity. So where we see ICCP used is if you have multiple power grids, they can each go in and send their information up to a centralized coordination center that can then be used to go in and reroute power to areas that need more power. So if we have one grid that is overutilizing and another grid that's underutilizing, each one of those can send up their information via ICCP. So then from a wholesale perspective, they can actually reroute the power accordingly to provide proper usage to proper areas. One of the areas that's used ICCP that we mentioned on day one is the Mid-Atlantic connection, where we've talked about part of Canada and part of the Mid-Atlantic area of the United States. I always call it MISO just to piss Mike off, but it's actually MISO. So we'll go in and put MISO there. They actually use, MISO uses ICCP to get information from all the respective power grids there to be able to balance the wholesale usage of that power to redirect it to areas that are either under or over utilized. Now, once again, we always have to balance the functionality and the security. So yes, ICCP is great for functionality, where now you're getting information up to a central source that can monitor, coordinate that information, but there's not a whole lot of security built into that. Now, yes, there's technically a secure ICCP, but it's not very secure. The authentication is not good. The certificate is fairly weak. It doesn't really scale or work the way that it should. So it's not really in widespread use that's out there. Also, something to be concerned about is you have security researchers that essentially pick protocols, target them, fuzz them, where literally they take every input, they try to send lots of data and lots of information to try to find vulnerabilities, issues, and problems out there. And as you can imagine, control systems is becoming more and more of a target. So a lot of these researchers are saying next year, they're going to be focusing energy on analyzing, fuzzing, and trying to find vulnerabilities and flaws in ICCP. So a lot of people are predicting in 2014, because security researchers are focusing their energy and effort on this protocol, that they will probably find a bunch of potential exposures, weaknesses, and vulnerabilities in that. So just to give you a heads up that if you're using ICCP, you just want to be careful that this is a focus area for researchers over the next 12 months. And we just want to make sure we track and watch that very closely. Now, Mike did a lot of the research and work at Idaho. So since he was here, I sort of felt funny of talking about and quoting his research. So I figured let's have it right from the source and have him talk about it. But as Mike said, the challenge you really have there is it would be like if I wanted to go in and set up secure communication between your house and my house. I don't control both of those pieces. So we would have to work or cooperate on setting that up, but I can't go into your house and install gear, and you can't come into my house and install gear. So because you don't control the two endpoints is where a lot of the challenges come into play. If I go in and I'm setting up communication links for my clients and I control both endpoints, I can do really good security. But if you only let me control one endpoint, I'm hoping the other side is doing what they're supposed to. And that's where the challenge is. Now, you might say, okay, Eric, but using my example, if it's just you and me, can't we communicate a lot? Can we make sure we're okay? Yes, but here's the problem. What if now it's not just your house? I want to communicate between my house and every one of your houses in here. Now, I could talk to you and we can get an agreement. But then if I talk to this gentleman and he does something different, now I have to change my gear to work here. And when I change my gear to work here, it might not work with you. So it's the many to many concept that creates the problem. If you're just doing one to one and you don't control the endpoints, you could do a lot of coordination. But it's when you have all of the multiple endpoints where the challenges come into play. So now that we've talked about the general types of networks and protocols that are there, now let's go in and look at how communication occurs over networks. Essentially, for communication to occur, there's two foundational things that are needed. The systems must be able to exchange data, and then they must be able to interpret the information in a meaningful manner. So the physical topology is how are you receiving the data? And the logical topology is what is the meaning of the information? So when we talk about computers, what we're really talking about is computers are binary devices. They only know two states, 0 or 1, open or closed. So computers are always going to transmit binary information back and forth to each other. So the question is, the physical topology is how is the binary data received? And the logical topology is what is the meaning of that information? Both of these are critical in order to understand, defend, and secure our communication. The physical topology is, in essence, how are the systems connected together. What's another way to state that? Your accurate, up-to-date network diagram. The physical topology is how are the systems interconnected and how does the data flow? And I know this might sound like an extreme statement, but it's really not. If you do not have an accurate, up-to-date network diagram, how can you make any claim of your security? Oh, Eric, we can claim we have good security because we have firewalls. We have data diodes. We have IDSs in place. A question for you. If you have a data diode, but you do not know how it's placed and how it's structured in the network, how do you know there's not ways bypassing, going around it, or not working correctly? I am not kidding you. We did an assessment for a utilities company where they claimed they were fully compliant because they had data diodes set up in their networks to control the flow of traffic. And once again, I can't make this stuff up if I wanted to. And in essence, if we went in and we looked at the breakdown of their networks, if this was their supervisory control network, and this was their data network, and you add these systems and this system, this is how it was designed. They went in and they had a data diode set up, and then they had a direct connection also set up in the environment. And they were claiming that they were compliant because we have a data diode. And I sat there and looked at him and said, seriously, you really want to have this discussion or argument? And they honestly, I don't think, realized how it was structured. They never put together an accurate diagram. They never traced the wires on it. And guess what? You can't go in and have a little sign. Bad people go here, good people go here, right? If there's a connection point, the adversary is going to take it. So in essence, because they never verified the physical topology, yes, they had a data diode. It wasn't doing anything. If you have a two-way link that's parallel to the one-way link, it's not going to accomplish much. We've seen cases where firewalls aren't plugged into the right network, IDSs aren't plugged into spanning ports, and on and on and on and on. So don't tell me you're secure because you have firewalls, IPSs, IDSs, and data diodes. Show me the actual connectivity and the verifiable flow of information. That's where, back to our day one, where I said you want your data flow diagrams. That's really what our physical topology is. How are the systems interconnected and how does the data flow? Because that's the only way you can verify that your security is plugged in correctly and going in and analyzing the right traffic and the right information. Having a device in your rack in your data center called a firewall doesn't make you secure if it's not plugged into the right area with the right information flow. So that's what the physical topology is all about, that accurate, up-to-date network diagram. Now, ideally, I would love it down to a granular device level. However, we do recognize that in large control system environments, they could be very, very complex, and in local field areas, technicians could be moving and changing gear periodically based on the requirements. However, what I want at a minimum is at least the network segments and the flow between the network segments. If you go in and within a field unit, you want to move around, add sensors, add motors, if they're all plugged into that same device and the data always flows from this network to that network in the same manner, that is acceptable at a high level. Ideally, you're going to have to get down to the device level, but at a starting point, I want to understand the networks, the connectivity between the networks, the sensitivity of the devices on each network, and the data flow between those networks. That's the high-level starting point, and then we can dig deeper after that. But you have to know how your systems are interconnected together. Otherwise, you're just checking boxes, and you have no idea of your security. So I had a student once saying, so Eric, you're telling me that I need to spend 4 months going in and creating a network diagram and a segmentation diagram because we have so much changes in place. We actually don't know how our systems are interconnected together, how our data flows and where the information is. So you're telling me that we need to spend 4 months putting together that accurate diagram. Yes, absolutely. Why? Everything else you're doing is futile. If you don't know how the systems are interconnected together, awesome. Buy more firewalls. Throw them on the network. How do you know if they're working? How do you know if they're tracking? How do you know if they're functioning correctly? You don't. So the trick is you got to get the fundamentals down if you want the big stuff to work correctly.